Welcome to the Science Podcast for February 24th, 2012. I'm Sarah Crespi. This week, ecological networks of networks, climate change in early horses, and science in India, plus a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Who eats what and when? That's the essence of a food web. While it may seem obvious that food webs in the same physical space might impinge on one another, measuring those interactions, networks of networks, has proven difficult. I spoke to Michael Pocock about the ties that bind food webs and how this higher level of data can help restoration projects.
As ecologists, we know that species interrelate to each other and they exist within food webs. And in this study, which was led by Jane Memmott at the University of Bristol, what we wanted to do was actually join together these food webs in order to reveal more of the complexity of the interactions between these species to give us a greater understanding of the sensitivity of species and ecosystems to environmental change.
Can you start with maybe a description of a food web and then which ones you considered in your study?
A food web would be a whole series of species, animals and plants, which interact together. In this study, we looked at lots of different types of these food webs, or more generally, interaction networks. So there were species which fed on others, there were animals which parasitized other insects, and there were pollinators in these as well. Within these networks that we looked at, we included species which provide ecosystem services, so they benefit human beings directly. And also those species regarded as bioindicators, which are often the sorts of species which people like to see in the countryside, so birds and butterflies and bees.
So how are you able to study so many different organisms and look at their interactions?
Well, previously, a lot of these species have been studied as food webs, but the food webs have been studied in isolation. And so what we wanted to do was actually join together these food webs to try and get a much bigger picture as to what was going on. Practically, this involved lots and lots of people doing lots and lots of field work. And I think one of the great things about it for me is a lot of these were going out in the field, they were sampling insects, they were rearing parasitoid wasps from insects in the lab, we were going out catching mammals and birds and then releasing them again. Doing all this sort of thing, which is quite old-fashioned in some senses, but we were then using cutting-edge analysis to answer questions of current concern.
And so you were looking at the interrelatedness of these networks and also their robustness. And
yes.
What did you learn about the interconnectedness of these food webs?
Well, certainly in terms of the robustness, what we did was we took all these interactions that we observed and measured in the field. And then within the computer, we modeled the effect of losing particular plants and how this cascades to different animal groups within this whole network of networks. And then we recognized that interconnectedness between these networks was potentially very important. And that's been shown in other studies. And even the fact that the financial institutions were very highly interconnected is thought to be one of the things that precipitated the banking crisis. So we knew that this interconnectedness could be really important. And so we looked at the robustness of animal groups to different scenarios of plant loss. And what we found that some groups were quite highly interconnected, so that scenarios of plant loss that were not so bad for one animal group were not so bad for others. Overall, though, what we found was that these responses showed that the interconnectedness across all the animal groups was less than we expected. So management that was good for one animal group was not inevitably good for other animal groups. That's what our results suggested.
One thing that your group did that was unique was that you did look across these multiple networks. Why hasn't that been done before?
So the reason that this hasn't been done before in ecology is that although ecologists have studied these food webs in isolation, one of the challenges is that in order to study them, you need a really high degree of expertise.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to develop that expertise, people often specialize in particular groups. And so what we needed to do was bring together a whole range of experts and a whole number of taxonomists to help with analyzing some of the samples that we were getting. Logistically, it's a very, very big job, and it's a job which requires lots of specialist expertise, which is why it's not been done before.
Huh. Well, your research looked at these interactions in the context of a farm in the UK. How generalizable are these findings? Do we need more studies in different parts of the world or in different settings?
Yes. We were interested in farmland for two main reasons, really, because biodiversity in farmland is known to be declining, and so therefore that's a conservation concern. And it's also that biodiversity within farmland provides benefits to farmers in the context of sustainable food production. So that's why we did it in farmland. But yes, in order to understand whether the general results that we got could be generalized across different ecosystems and different parts of the world, then definitely we would say that studies like this should be attempted in these different systems.
And so how might this be useful, this result be useful for farmers?
Well, I think it's useful because for farmers and for policymakers as well, because the varying fragility of the different animal groups, which appeared to be the case from our data, shows potentially where conservation effort ought to be focused for maximum benefit. And that's important then for farmers because they can get the benefits back in terms of these and what we would call ecosystem service provisions. One of the other things which looking at this whole network of networks allowed us to do was to be able to identify plants within the network which appeared to be particularly important. And so it could be the case that these particular plants could be focused on for restoration schemes within farmland because they will give maximum benefit to the biodiversity. Huh. We would recommend that the specific plants chosen are actually tested in the field, but our data provides this information in order to guide which species ought to be tested.
And so what are the next steps for this project?
Well, I said that plants could be the focus for restoration efforts. In actual fact, what tends to be the case is it's the habitats which are focuses for restoration. And so that's one of the things that we're beginning to look at within the farmland context, which of the habitats are most important and ought to be focuses for restoration. One of the other things is that in some senses, I think our project ought to be viewed as a hypothesis-generating project. And I think it's necessary in order to have messages which can be relayed to policymakers directly and recommendations given to policymakers that these hypotheses need to be tested firmly in the field. And I think the other thing is we've shown how networks of networks are interrelated is important, but there are many other ways in which we need to explore the complexity of these interrelationships. One example is insects do different things at different stages in their life cycle. And so I think pushing forward the study of ecological networks, we need to take more consideration of those sorts of things.
Well, Michael Pocock, thank you for talking with me.
Okay, that's a pleasure. Thank you.
Michael Pocock and colleagues write about ecological networks on a farm in Science This Week. My Little Ponies may be fictional characters in a fantasy world created for children, but millions of years ago, similarly sized horses roamed the earth without the pastel colors or charming personalities. These horses stood only a foot or so tall, and according to Ross Secord of the University of Nebraska, they became even smaller during a period of warming 56 million years ago. Secord spoke with Carrie about why this may have happened and what it might mean today as our climate continues to change.
Okay, the study is about the relationship between climate change and body size in the earliest known horses, which were really small little things, only about 12 inches high, during an interval of ancient global warming called the Paleocene-Eocene Thermal Maximum. Lasted for about 175,000 years, began about 56 million years ago. We've known for about two decades that many mammal species get smaller in this interval, but now we have a high-resolution record that shows the details of body size changes within the Paleocene-Eocene Thermal Maximum. And so that's the main focus of this paper.
Okay, so let's start by talking about the Paleocene, Eocene thermal maximum. How is this time period characterized? What do we know about it?
Well, we have records both on the continents and in the marine realm, so it's known globally. And what happens at this time is that there were billions of tons of carbon that went into the atmosphere at this time. And there's a number of proxies, marine proxies and proxies on the continents too, that shows that there was major warming that happened during this interval on the order of 5 to 10 degrees centigrade.
And now, talking about these early horses, how are you able to precisely correlate their sizes to the climate during this time period?
So here, the methodology for body size, we use tooth area there. We use first lower molar tooth area, which we know is highly correlated to body size based on modern mammals. And so we get body size based on the size of teeth. So we see tooth size changing through this interval. And then as a climate record, we're using oxygen isotope values in a mammal called Coryphodon. And Coryphodon's a fairly special mammal. It was the largest mammal that lived at its time. The reason we're interested in oxygen isotope values is because we know in the modern world that there's a very strong correlation at mid-latitudes and high latitudes between the oxygen isotope values in precipitation and mean annual temperature. So anyway, we're using oxygen isotope values in Coryphodon then as a temperature proxy. And what we saw then is a very strong correlation between those values and our body size changes through this interval. The actual causes of that are still being debated. So one of the ideas here is that there's an optimization of body size. The larger that an animal is, the harder it is for that animal to lose heat from its body. And so that's an advantage if you're at higher latitudes where it's colder, but if you're in a warm area, it's an advantage to be smaller and to be able to lose heat faster. But that's one interpretation, and a lot of people still follow that. But other people have argued that it really doesn't work that way for physiological reasons, and that that it's more related to the availability of food or the productivity of the environment.
Now, there are a number of other possible drivers for evolution, for this change in body size over time. What about things like predation, competition? How can you rule those out?
Yeah, that's a good question, and we did consider that. So one of the other things that I didn't mention that happens during the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum is that this is a time of major immigration. We see the first representatives of many modern mammal orders, the first primates, the first artiodactyls and perissodactyls. These are two different orders of ungulates that show up at this time in North America, and they're coming in as immigrants, and there's other immigrants coming in, too, from other continents. So the whole fauna is changing at this time. And so one possibility would be that there's competition and things like that going on through this interval. But there's very good reasons to think that that really doesn't have anything to do with the body size changes we're looking at. And those reasons are that we see size change in almost 40% of the fauna, including the ones that are there before this interval. The horses come in as an immigrant, but there's a number of taxa that are around in the late Paleocene. We see them decrease in body size during the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum and then increase again at the end of it. And so essentially we're seeing almost 40% of the fauna get smaller and then get larger again. And we don't have the higher resolution records that we do for the horses with these other taxa, but it's clear that they're getting smaller. It's almost like a coordinated shift in body size. And for that reason, it does not appear to be related to competition or anything like that that's happening. And nothing gets larger during this interval is another interesting thing, too. So for those reasons, it seems very unlikely that it's related to things like competition among mammals that are already there or new mammals that are coming in.
So how easy is it to take the patterns derived from the fossil record here 56 million years ago and apply them to the future as we continue down this path of climate change?
Should we come out of this study fearful that humans are going to start shrinking, humans and other mammals?
Well, no, I don't think we need to worry about humans changing in body size because we regulate our own temperature, obviously, you know, with heating our homes and all that kind of thing. We pretty much have our temperatures regulated wherever we go, at least in the industrial world. So the larger question is, are we going to see changes in mammals and other animals due to warming in the coming century or two? And a number of people have been suggesting that we will. There is evidence that birds are getting smaller, and we may expect to see the same thing happen in mammals too. Now, you can point to the record, and you can also find some things that are getting larger at this time, so it's not everything that's shifting in that direction. So it's a good question, but it's a difficult one to answer, and one of the reasons for that is because during the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum, warming is happening at a much slower rate than it is now. The initial pulse of warming that we saw there happened over possibly 20,000 years or so, and now we're looking at an increase which may be comparable over the next century or so, looking at some of the climate models. So it's happening at a much faster rate. We think that the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum is a good example because the magnitude of warming is about the same, but the rate is much different. And so the question is, are mammals going to be able to keep up with that? Will they be able to change their body size, you know, quickly enough to adapt to changing temperature? And we don't really know. And the other factor here is that we know there were very high CO2 concentrations during the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum. We're seeing CO2 concentrations increase now, too. What happens there is as you increase CO2 levels, the nutritional content of plants goes down. Less nitrogen in the plants and lower protein content. And so that could cause natural selection to act on it for a smaller body size, or it could have a direct effect, too. So increased CO2 levels could be a factor as well that may be causing body size shifts. So, yeah, it's still a question that's fairly open, difficult to predict, but I think what we can say is that the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum is an example of one possible thing that may happen over the next century or two. But we can't say for certain that that's going to be the outcome.
Well, I guess we'll just have to wait and see. Ross Secord, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Ross Secord and colleagues report on climate change-driven horse evolution during the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum in a report this week. While many governments are cutting back on spending, India is doubling down on science over the next 5 years. I spoke with Science's contributing correspondent, Pallava Bagla, about how this money will be used to expand research and the scientific community in the country.
Today, India is in a very important stage of development. India's economy is growing at about 7% annually. And India has had an immense role of science and technology in its development process. So today, when the Prime Minister in his interview talks of doubling of the investments in science and technology from 1% of the gross domestic product of India to 2% of the gross domestic product of India, that is a very significant statement. Now, to put it in perspective, India is a country which makes its own atomic reactors, makes its own satellites, makes its own rockets, has recently made its own nuclear submarine, and is also self-sufficient in food. So there's a lot of application work which is happening, but the basic science work has suffered a little bit. But these new huge investments which are going to take place are probably going to make a difference.
So, as you say, there are big developments going on in science in India right now, but what about the historical context? How has India invested and experienced science over the past few decades?
See, India has had a great history of investments in science and technology. The first Prime Minister of the country, Jawaharlal Nehru, called the laboratories of India as the modern temples. There was a lot of investments in the elite institutions of the Indian Institutes of Technology, one of them which was set up in Kanpur with American collaboration, which has produced some of the finest brains today, and a lot of them rule the roost in the Silicon Valley in America. But at the same time, over the years, the investments have been very large in the strategic sectors. Strategic sectors meaning atomic energy, mm-hmm. defense research, and the space technology. But investments in other areas have probably come down a little bit. That correction is happening. But there was a great watershed moment for India in science and technology, which was when in 1974, India exploded its first nuclear bomb at Pokhran in Rajasthan. After that, a lot of sanctions and technology denial regimes were strapped on India by many Western countries, including USA. Mm-hmm. And that caused a dramatic shift in the way India does its technology, does its science.
Some say that the ban on the high-tech trade with these other countries was good for India's technological development.
Well, that is a view many of the space scientists, many of the nuclear scientists mm-hmm. in India believe. When India wanted to import in the 70s and 80s a supercomputer from America, which was denied to India, saying that you can use the supercomputer for making missiles and bombs, what did the Indians do? The Indians went ahead and made their own supercomputer. When the sophisticated engines used to fly civilian satellites to space, that technology was denied. The Indians went ahead and made their own technology called the cryogenic engine technology.
And as you say, a lot of that was focused on space and defense research. But this new government agency and a large increase in science funding has a focus on other initiatives. What kinds of things are included in that package?
India has what is called a five-year plan, which kicks in sometime in April this year and will go on till 2017. India currently invests about $3 billion in R&D in India, which is inclusive of both the private sector and the public sector. But by 2017, which is 5 years from now, the Prime Minister hopes that figure will go up to $8 billion annually, which is more than doubling of the figure. And in that, there are several initiatives which are planned. One of them is to have a large supercomputing facility being built up in Bangalore. That will take up about $1 billion. There's a new India-based neutrino observatory which is to come up. And there are many other smaller initiatives like the monsoon forecasting initiative. There's a large initiative which India is trying to try and see if they can forecast earthquakes.
Yeah.
India is a very earthquake-prone country. And if a magnitude 9 earthquake happens in any of the Himalayan regions, a lot of people say that 70% of the capital city, New Delhi, would probably go down. Wow. So there's a huge investment happening in trying to see if they can find precursors to earthquakes or predict earthquakes.
So can you also give us a brief overview of what they're calling the monsoon mission?
India today depends so much on the rains which come during the June to September period in the country. And forecasting when there would be a dry spell, when there would be a wet spell in that monsoon period is something which the scientists have not been able to do. So the new plan of the government is to invest many million dollars into a project which will forecast the monsoons well, which is called the monsoon mission, which will not only increase observation, but also increase the modeling capacity for the scientists.
Another focus is also going to be more money into the space program. What are the plans for that?
In 2008, India conducted its first mission to the moon called Chandrayaan 1, which was an unmanned mission to the moon, which cost just about $100 million. The key outcome was that the Chandrayaan mission, through its partners in NASA, brought back clinching evidence of the availability of water on the moon. So the same kind of work is being extended now. India wants to send a probe to an asteroid, later send a probe, an unmanned satellite, to Mars. And there is a very ambitious program to send Indians in space using Indian rockets from Indian soil, which is to have an astronaut program from India, for which the Indian Space Research Organization is seeking government approval for the tune of $2.5 billion. Now, the government has as yet not cleared that project. So there is many proposals like that which are in the offing.
So talking about the research community that India has already built up, it's still pretty small. Will some of this money be going to schools to develop the research community further?
India may be a country of 1.2 billion people, but the number of people who go for higher degrees is very small. And the number of people who opt for doing research is even smaller. There was a huge gap, and that gap has been bridged by the new initiatives which have been taken by Prime Minister Manmohan Singh to start over 100 elite institutions in the country. But yes, there is a very large gap in the number of trained people available in the country to do high-quality work.
And why focus on institutions or institutes rather than universities?
No, the focus is also on universities. So there are many institutes which are both research and teaching, and there are many new universities which are being set up called innovation universities. And then you also have setting up of many engineering institutes, the clones of the Indian Institutes of Technology or the IITs, which are very well known across the world. But in the last couple of decades, the amount of work which was done in universities by way of research has kind of come down a little bit. That is where the government is trying very hard to leverage and to increase funding so that more and more people get attracted to do research in universities.
So once all these people obtain these advanced degrees and participate in research, this initiative will also help them get jobs and stay in India?
That is certainly. Today, India is making efforts to increase faculty by increasing the number of teachers available in universities and also attracting people who are teaching overseas to try and come back to India at least for part of the year to teach in various places. So once you have an increase in the skilled base of people, the chances that many of them will continue to work in India are very high.
Well, there is a lot of poverty in India. How is this whole slew of investment in new technology and research development going to benefit the country as a whole?
See, India looks at science and technology as one of the spearheads to remove poverty in the country. The belief in the country is that if you have indigenously developed science and through it technology, then the development path which you can take is going to be something in which there can be inclusive development. And inclusive development would come about through the use of science and technology. And that was something also which the Prime Minister in his interview to Science emphasized very clearly, that he feels that Indian science has a very bright future, provided the scientists start talking and convincing people and the political class of the usefulness of their work.
Mm-hmm. Well, Pallava Bagla, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Pallava Bagla reports on the state of science in India in a News Focus this week. Finally today, David Grimm, online news editor of Science, is here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. So, David, first up, we have the last of the news from the AAAS meeting, a story on global fisheries.
Right, Sarah. This story came out actually towards the end of the meeting, and it's about the agreements that some countries make with other countries to fish their waters. And the idea is that as global demand for seafood continues to rise, fishing fleets have to travel farther and farther to bring home a catch, and some countries have to travel so far they're actually in other countries' waters and they have to broker deals that allow them to fish these waters. Well, what this new study says is that a lot of these countries are, for lack of a better word, sort of getting hosed by these agreements. This particular study focused on an agreement between the European Union and Madagascar. Scientists found that although Madagascar thought that it was giving away a certain amount of fish to the EU by allowing it to fish in certain waters with its big fishing fleets, turns out that Madagascar wasn't taking into account smaller scale fishing operations and recreational activities that the EU was also engaging in their waters. And therefore, the final fishery catches that the EU was actually bringing home could have been up to six times higher than the commercial catch numbers that Madagascar was counting on.
And where was Madagascar getting those numbers?
The numbers actually come from the United Nations, which have numbers on how much fishing fleets around the world catch. And again, that's what Madagascar was basing it on. It wasn't taking into account these smaller scale activities. So they're actually losing a lot more fish from their water than they think they are, and they're not getting compensated for it.
And there's another catch here to this fishing story.
Right.
Inflation is also playing a part.
Inflation is also hurting countries like Madagascar. The team found that even though the EU was paying more year after year for rights to fish in Madagascar's water, in 1986, for example, the EU was paying 1.1 million euros and paying 1.7 million euros in 2010, there was actually an inflation rate of 12%. So actually in the long run, Madagascar was also losing money on that deal.
Maybe this study will have an impact on how the UN counts the fish.
Exactly.
Next up, we have a story on thieving elephants in Kenya.
Right, from fish to elephants. This next story is all about whether male elephants make bad role models. And the study has to do with a group of elephants that live outside Amboseli National Park, which is just north of Mount Kilimanjaro in Kenya. And what happens in this area is locals often wake up to find that their carefully sown tomatoes and onions have been pulled up and their fields mangled. And the evidence left behind is a few tracks and, for lack of a better word, some elephant poop. And so they know the elephants are causing the damage. What they don't know is why they're doing it.
So how do they figure out why an elephant was eating crops? I mean, it does seem like a buffet for
right.
an elephant, right?
Well, it's a really good question. The thing is that elephants have plenty of other food opportunities. So it doesn't really make sense for them to go after crops, especially since farmers can get angry and the elephants certainly don't want that. What the researchers figured out is that older male elephants go through a period called must, which is basically a prolonged period of heightened testosterone and aggression levels, which male elephants begin when they reach their full reproductive potential, which is around 45 or 50 years old. Elephants actually live pretty long. But males entering must don't just go around looking for mates like you'd expect. They actually go on rampages. And when they go on these rampages, they actually use up a lot of their energy. So when it comes time to finding food, raiding a farmer's crops is actually a lot less energy than going out and finding your food out there in the wild.
So they are visiting the buffet.
They are visiting the buffet, but what's most interesting, the researchers found, is that a lot of younger elephants are doing this as well, elephants that are not going through must. So the question is, why are they doing it? And it turns out that younger elephants were sort of looking up to the older males as role models. The youngsters tended to run in packs with the older bulls, as they're called, and they were actually learning these behaviors from them. And researchers have seen this in female elephants, too. Female elephants will often teach their young where to find watering holes. So it's clear that in elephant society, the younger elephants learn from the older ones. But in this case, the younger elephants are actually learning bad manners from the older ones.
So what can farmers do to break the cycle of violence and thievery?
Well, what the researchers say is that the farmers should put up more of a fuss than they are currently, especially when the older male elephants come around. And if the older male elephants really begin to associate raiding these crops with being shouted at, being shot at, whatever it is, they're probably less likely to do it and therefore less likely to pass these bad behaviors on to younger males.
Okay. Well, last up, we have more exoplanet news. Some planets are alien invaders.
Right, Sarah. Well, this story is all about the idea that suns can capture wandering worlds out there in the universe. We tend to think that solar systems sort of form as they are. A bunch of planets form from what's called a protoplanetary disk that surrounds a sun, and that's all you have. But there's a lot of unexplained planets out there. When astronomers have been looking through space, they found that there are planets that are orbiting very far from their home suns, much farther out than actually Pluto even orbits from our own sun. And the question is, did those planets really form there, or were they somehow captured by the sun's gravity and dragged into the solar system from empty space?
So what's the new evidence that this might be going on?
It's actually known that there's a lot of free-floating planets out there. In fact, we recently ran a story that suggested that free-floating planets may be as abundant as stars in the universe. So there's a lot of them out there. What this team of researchers did was they ran some computer simulations, and they found that if that's indeed the case, if the number of free-floating planets equals the number of stars, then 3% to 6% of the stars will succeed in capturing a planet. And some stars could capture as many as 2 or 3 planets. Now, most of these captured planets end up hundreds of thousands of times farther from the sun than Earth is from our sun. So these guys are really orbiting way far out there, but they're still part of the solar system because they're still orbiting the sun.
So is there any chance that our solar system could have one of these extremely distant planets?
Well, that's the billion-dollar question. Is there a planet out there beyond Pluto? And some astronomers have suggested that there is. We haven't seen it yet, and we don't know if it's there, but this new study suggests that it could be there.
Wow. Well, maybe we'll be writing about that next year.
Right.
So what else is on the news site this week?
Well, Sarah, for Science Now, we've got a story about a virus that uses an iron spike to invade bacterial cells. Also a story about a type of fish that blows jets of water at its prey. For Science Insider, we've got a story about how the faster-than-light neutrinos, quote-unquote, that created quite a controversy a few months back may not be so faster than light after all. We're also continuing our coverage of the H5N1 controversial flu papers. What's the latest in terms of the controversy surrounding their publication? Finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's Science Live is about the future of fusion research in the United States. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, David.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the online news editor for Science. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. And that concludes the February 24th, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.